beating the odds against the Nazis at the 1936 Olympic Games.
So these poor guys, these American kids, they rode out into the windiest, widest part of the longer sea, this body of water. And 1,000 meters down the course, they were dead last. And they were watching Germany and Italy, the two fascist powers, streaking down lanes 1 and 2 towards what seemed like an inevitable victory.
That's Daniel James Brown. We talk with him about his best-selling book, The Boys in the Boat. Then a retelling of the story of Romeo and Juliet from the point of view of Juliet's nurse.
She's, I think, often in the play written off as comic, but she's also very tragic. She's had that child who died, and as it turns out, a fairly common experience that hiring wet nurses was very common in Italy in this period. It's the 14th century. But I didn't want to make her defined just by that.
That's Lois Levine. Her new novel is Juliet's Nurse. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Everybody loves a story about an underdog who ekes out victory against the odds. But when the underdogs are a bunch of working-class guys struggling to build a great rowing team in the depths of the Great Depression, and their opponents are the elite athletes of Nazi Germany, the story is truly enthralling. Daniel James Brown's gripping account, The Boys in the Boat, is about how 9 American boys from the West Coast defeated Hitler's rowing team to gain the gold at the 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin. More than just a sports tale, the New York Times bestseller situates the story within the larger context of class, prejudice, and world events to give the reader a full picture of just how great was the victory of the boys in the boat. I spoke with Daniel James Brown earlier this fall. Well, Daniel James Brown, welcome to Writer's Voice. This wonderful book is the story of the 1936 Olympic 8-oar crew team from the University of Washington that won the gold. And it's also a very personal as well as a historical story. You begin in 1933, the fourth year of the Great Depression. Tell us a little bit about the historical setting first.
The story, in its earliest part of it at least, is set in the Pacific Northwest. And so I spend a lot of time learning about Seattle and Western Washington State during the Depression. And it was really somewhat eye-opening for me to realize just how tough life was. This book's about basically 9 young men who come from various rural and small-town places around Washington State, kids that grew up on dairy farms and in mill towns in western Washington. And none of them had 2 nickels to rub together. And when they showed up at the University of Washington in the fall of 1933, they all wanted to become university educated, but the only way they could stay in the university was if they had some sort of part-time job at least. And as long as they got onto and stayed on the school's crew, they were assured of a part-time job on the campus. So for a lot of these kids, just making the crew and staying on it was almost literally a matter of survival, certainly of getting through school and realizing their dreams. So yeah, the backdrop, in this country was that the Great Depression was in full swing. And one of the things I try to do in the book is I drop the reader periodically into Germany during the same period. And so as you're following the story of these boys coming together to become a great crew, you're also seeing what's beginning to unfold in Germany between 1933 and 1936. And that, of course, was a lot of learning for me in terms of that, too, and that was very eye-opening and very chilling.
Yeah, and we'll get into some of that, but I first want to ask you about, there is a central character here in this book. His name is Joe Rance. He was a poor kid, like the other kids, but even poorer, and grew up in extremely difficult circumstances. Why did you pick him as a touchstone for the story, and then tell us about him and his background?
You know, I think he was the perfect touchstone because he was the poorest kid in the boat, although they were all more or less poor. But Joe's personal circumstances, the very difficult family situation he had, he was basically abandoned by his family right at the beginning of the Depression. The struggle he had to simply stay alive, foraging in the woods for berries and poaching salmon from the Dungeness River, the struggle that he had in many ways sort of gives body and form to the struggle that so many Americans had in that period of history. And I really think that he is a good stand-in for what so many ordinary Americans went through in the deepest part of the Depression. And so he became the natural touchstone. And part of what's interesting about Joe is that even though he had these very difficult circumstances, he was a remarkably positive and forward-looking young man and old man. Even when I met him, he was dying. He remained extraordinarily forward-looking and positive. And then that was true of most of these kids who came together in this crew. And I really think that's an important part of their success and an important part of the story was the kind of character that they had. So for me, Joe is almost the perfect stand-in, as I say, for your average young American in 1933 through 1936.
Well, the average young American must have been of a far finer metal than your average young American,
yeah,
or even older American now. In fact, he was the one, or his daughter was the one, who led you into the story to begin with.
Yeah, you know, this story, I mean, it's kind of a writer's dream, but this story literally walked into my living room one day 6 years ago. His daughter, Judy, came to me, and Joe was at the time, in the last couple months of his life, living under hospice care at her house. And she'd been reading one of my earlier books to him, and he was really enjoying that. So she came to my house, and she said, "Will you come down and meet my dad?" So I went down the next day, I think it was, and I met, you know, what was then this elderly gentleman, Joe Rance, and he was very weak, he was on oxygen, but he was very alert mentally. And we talked just for a minute about that earlier book, but then he began to talk about his experience as a child growing up during the Depression, and he unfolded this extraordinary story, and I fell into that, and I was just mesmerized by that. And then he began to talk about how he and his crewmates had come together over 3 years and become this crew that wound up rowing for a gold medal at the Olympics in 1936 against a German boat in front of Hitler and Goebbels and Goering and all the top Nazis. And I was just, by the time he was done, my jaw was hanging open. It was such an extraordinary story. And so, actually, I asked Joe that very day. I hadn't gone down there expecting to find a book topic, but I was just so drawn into it. I said, "Joe, can I write a book about your life?" And he shook his head immediately, and he looked down at the floor and said, "No, I don't want you to write a book about me." But then he looked up, and he had tears in his eyes, and he said, but you could write a book about the boat." And at first, I didn't know what he meant. I thought he meant this beautiful handcrafted cedar racing shell, the boat itself that they had rowed in. But we talked a little more, and I suddenly realized what he meant by the boat was, of course, the crew, all the boys that had rowed with him, but something even more than that, really, this sort of almost perfect thing that they had all become together that summer in Berlin 75 years before. So that's how the story got started. I was just hooked immediately. I started working on the book the very next day.
It is an extraordinary story. And also, just tell us a little bit about what he had to battle to get to the University of Washington. How, you know, something about what forged him as such a person with his own inner demons, but somebody with true grit.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, what happened to Joe was his own mother died very when he was very young. And his father remarried a much younger woman who became Joe's stepmother. And from the very beginning, she just didn't have much use for Joe. I think she thought of Joe as a reminder of her husband's first marriage. And so the whole time Joe was growing up, she was basically trying to get him out of the house, get rid of him. And finally, one dark winter day in out in the Olympic Peninsula here, the family just drove away and left Joe standing in the rain. And he had to, over the next few years, he had to learn to survive entirely on his own, foraging for berries in the woods. And what that taught him was, initially, that he couldn't trust anybody but himself. And he learned to depend only on himself. And he became a very self-reliant, very strong young man. And that was all good and well, and it helped him a lot, until he stepped into a rowing shell. And the thing about rowing is that it's not about the individual. It's entirely about trusting other people and becoming part of something larger, giving yourself up to something larger, which is getting the boat to move fast and to win. And so it was very hard for Joe. The first couple of years he was rowing, he was so used to doing things by himself and trusting only himself. He had a hard time building the bonds with the other people in the boat that he needed to build. He tried to row the boat across the finish line all by himself, basically, and that just doesn't work in crew. So it was only in the third year, in fact, in the spring before they wound up going to the Olympics, that he finally began to learn with the help of this man named George Pocock, this almost sage-like figure, the boat builder at Washington, that he finally learned to put aside his ego and start trusting the other young men in the boat. And that really was the key. That was when the boat really started to move.
Well, Daniel James Brown, in the book, The Boys in the Boat, like what you have just talked about, it's really a book about the lessons that people learned, not just the boys in the boat, but that the reader can learn in reading the book, a number of different lessons. One, you've talked about working as a team. The other lessons do center on George Pocock, the boat designer. Tell us more about him. You had many of the chapters with quotes from him that encapsulate some of these lessons.
Yeah, George Pocock was born in Great Britain. He was apprenticed to his father as a boat builder for the racing shells at Eton College in England. He immigrated to the United States in, I think it was 1912, and wound up in Seattle building these beautiful cedar racing shells. And he was such a craftsman that by the mid-1930s, every rowing program in America wanted a Pocock shell. They were both works of art. They were so beautiful, but they were also state-of-the-art boats in those days. They were exquisitely well-crafted. And the thing about Pocock was he was a very spiritual man, almost a sage in some ways, a very wise man. And he was also a very good oarsman. So he wound up, although the boys had a coach, he wound up coaching the boys a lot on the side. And it was him, he was the one who taught Joe in particular, but taught all of them about the importance of becoming part of something larger than yourself, giving up something of yourself to become part of something larger. And so his spirit and this sort of lesson that he imbued in all of them runs through everything he wrote. He wrote quite a bit. And so, yeah, I started every chapter with a quote from Pocock because I wanted his spirit to sort of imbue the whole book the way that it imbued the spirit in that shell house as this crew was coming together. He was an enormously important part of their success.
And, of course, the other very important mentor to Joe and the others was Al Ulbrichsen. He was the coach. Tell us a bit about him.
Yeah, and Al Ulbrichsen was the other sort of side of the equation who helped make this crew great. Ulbrichsen was a very different kind of man than Pocock. He was very stern. He was very reticent. He didn't like to betray emotion, particularly in front of his boys. He was quite hard. He was a taskmaster. He demanded an enormous amount from the boys. Many of them were afraid of him to some extent. But he developed great athletes, and in particular, he was good at sort of mixing and matching individuals to find the best combination that would make a good crew. A rowing coach recently told me that he would never clone the biggest, strongest man or woman in one of his boats and just fill the boat up with clones of that biggest, strongest man or woman. The crews aren't built that way. Crews are built from the right combination of a diverse set of physical strengths and also psychological types. It's really kind of an alchemy, putting together the combination that will make the boat go really fast. And so Ulbrichsen's brilliance was that he was very good at doing that alchemy, at finding the right formula. And in fact, it wasn't until the spring of 1936 when Joe finally started to row well and Ulbrichsen finally put him in the boat that would wind up going to the Olympics. It was literally the day that he put Joe in the number 7 seat that boat really took off. If you look at the logs of the times that Ulbrichsen kept, you can see it very starkly in the numbers. That boat just went faster than any boat in the whole program had ever gone from the moment they put Joe into that boat. So that was Ulbrichsen's great contribution, was knowing what he was dealing with and mixing and matching.
And what was that alchemical note that Joe in the position of number 7 gave to the boat?
You know, I think it was, Joe had known a lot of the boys in that boat earlier in his rowing career. But as they say, he hadn't really learned to trust anybody. By the spring of 1936, when he finally got in that boat, he had by then come to know these boys, and he did trust them. And he sort of let loose and let himself row with abandon, knowing that everybody in the boat was going to be pulling just as hard as he was and pulling just as precisely as he was. And so it was a breakthrough for him on a personal, psychological level, and it was also an enormous, you know, breakthrough for the crew. So it was really, again, I just can't emphasize this enough, it was all about trust.
So how did the University of Washington team get to the Olympics? Maybe just give us a brief sense of their arc, because it wasn't traditional for the Western rowing teams to be, you know, number one.
Right. Part of the appeal of this story for me and for readers, it seems, is that your usual conception of rowing, I think the conception most people have is that it was and is a sort of elite sport conducted primarily at Ivy League schools in the East. These boys broke that mold. These were kids who grew up in, as they say, on dairy farms and in mill towns around Western Washington. They grew strong wielding axes and pitchforks. To get where they ultimately got, to the Olympics, they had to go up against and compete against and vanquish kids who had learned to row in prep schools in the East, kids who in many cases were the sons of business tycoons or U.S. senators or even presidents of the United States. Two of FDR's kids rowed at the time. They had to row against these elite kids from the elite schools. Then they had to go up against and row against the kids who were considered the best in the world, kids from Oxford and Cambridge in England. They had to defeat them. And then they had to go on and defeat this hand-picked Nazi crew in Germany. And so they were improbable from the beginning because they were just a bunch of rough and tumble kids from the woods of the Northwest. And that was part of their appeal in their day. Also, a lot of Americans in the middle of the Depression could really identify with a bunch of ordinary working class American kids taking on these, you know, different echelons of privilege and prestige and actually beating them. So it was a story that made people feel good about themselves in the very, very dark time of the Depression.
And it wasn't always all that certain that they might make it to the Olympics. Even once they made it to the team, there was a lot of controversy over the 1936 Olympics. Let's shift the lens a little bit now to, you know, Goebbels and the role of the Munich Olympics, the role that played, what it was all about. I mean, there was this magnificent film made by Leni Riefenstahl. You tell that story as well.
Yeah, you know, I didn't know when I started this book. I think, like most Americans, I knew a fair amount about Germany, Nazi Germany during the war and, of course, the Holocaust. But I didn't know a lot about Germany in the mid-1930s. And so the research I did really opened my eyes to how deliberately and cynically the Nazis, particularly Joseph Goebbels, who was the minister of propaganda, used the Olympic Games as a vast propaganda tool designed to conceal the reality of what was really happening in Germany from the world. You know, they turned Berlin into almost a movie set. They literally got down on hands and knees and scrubbed the streets and whitewashed buildings. They rounded up all the homeless people in Berlin and the gypsies in Berlin and sent them off to camps from which they never returned. They created a sort of fantasy version of Germany where you only saw good things, you only saw positive things that would lift one up. And it worked. I mean, thousands of Americans went to Berlin that summer, and thousands of Americans came back believing that Germany was a clean, modern, prosperous, forward-looking, civilized nation. And even as, behind the scenes, the Nazis were building up their armies, they were building Dachau that summer that these Olympics took place. But they concealed all that behind the facade of goodwill that they showed during the Olympic Games. So that was all enormously enlightening to me, and I really tried to drop the reader as I'm tracing the story of these boys becoming a great team here in the U.S. I do drop the reader into Germany every now and then so they can see how this is unfolding.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Daniel James Brown about the American rowing team that won the gold at the 1936 Olympic Games in Hitler's Berlin. His book is The Boys in the Boat.
You know, at the same time that they're rounding up gypsies and Jews and social democrats and communists, you have Avery Brundage of the, what position exactly did he play?
It was the U.S. Olympic Committee, head of the U.S. Olympic Committee.
And he said, Avery Brundage says, quote, "No nation since ancient Greece has captured the true Olympic spirit as has Germany." So talk a little bit about Avery Brundage, the head of the U.S. Olympic Committee, and did he get snowed under, or how typical was he?
He got pretty snowed. He was probably fairly typical. We forget how much anti-Semitism there was in the United States in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. The Jewish community, particularly in New York, did have a sense of what was happening in Germany because they were hearing from their relatives in Germany. And so there was an effort to boycott the 36 Olympics. Brundage was implacably opposed to that, even as evidence mounted of what was happening in Germany. And he was, in fact, a big promoter of Germany in the public view. And so he fought the boycott tooth and nail. And I didn't really realize this until I started doing the research for this book, but I came away believing that Brundage's motives were really basically anti-Semitic. He had an attitude towards Jewish Americans that just wouldn't be accepted today as tolerable. And so the boycott movement failed. I mean, I guess the upside is we got some great stories out of the Olympics, like the Jesse Owens story and the story of these boys in the boat. But yeah, he very much crushed the boycott movement, and I personally am not very sympathetic to his view of the world.
And in fact, he was probably unaware, as were the other folks on the Olympic Committee and on the boat on the Olympic team, that one of their members was actually Jewish.
Yeah, the coxswain in the boat. The coxswain is the short man or woman who sits in the back of the boat and shouts out the commands. Bobby Mock, the coxswain for this crew, knew that he had relatives in Europe. So when they had won the right to go to Berlin as Team USA, Bob Mock, they were in New York, Bob Mock wrote home back here to Seattle and asked his father to send the address of his relatives in Germany. And he waited a long while, and finally an envelope came. And inside the envelope, there was another envelope, and it said, "Open this in a private place." So Bob went out in a field and sat under a tree, and he opened it, and he learned for the first time that he was Jewish, that his entire family history was Jewish. And his daughter Marilyn said that when he read that, he started crying. And it wasn't because he was upset at discovering he was Jewish. He was just horrified that his father had felt it necessary in America to conceal from him and from his family and from the people he lived with and worked with, felt it necessary to conceal his Jewish heritage. That really upset Bob. And so he went to Germany knowing that he was Jewish for the first time.
Must have been an incredible moment, because he was the one who actually received the gold up on the stand.
Yes, he was the one that stood on the podium and received the gold medal, exactly.
So now let's rewind a little bit back from that moment. When the team first got there, their practice sessions were not all that great, and they faced some incredible difficult situations. One of them was really sick. They got assigned these lanes that were basically a handicap. The weather was horrendous. What turned it around?
They got off to a terrible start. They were assigned the windiest lane, and that was despite the fact they had turned in the fastest qualifying time. Germany, which had slow qualifying time, was assigned the most protected lane, lane one. Don Hume, their stoke oar, the most critical oar, had been running a high fever, was terribly sick. It was so windy they didn't hear the signal when the race was started, so they didn't know the race had started until they saw the boats to one side move forward. So these poor guys, these American kids, they rowed out into the windiest, widest part of the longer sea, this body of water. And 1,000 meters down the course, which is halfway through the course, they were dead last. And they were watching Germany and Italy, the two fascist powers, streaking down lanes one and two towards what seemed like an inevitable victory. And the second half of that race, I don't want to spoil it by telling too much, but it's just extraordinary, the nature. I will tell you, they won the race. That's, you know that from the minute you pick the book up. But what really is very compelling is how they won that race in the second half. It was one of the great comebacks, I think, in Olympic history.
It is. It is amazing. Now, you come back to Joe at the end. How did this experience change him? And then I'd like you to tell us how it might have changed you.
I think all these guys, all nine of them, were very proud of what they had done. But they were also a very humble bunch of guys, which I think was part of the ticket to their success. These were guys that mostly, when they came home, they put their gold medals in sock drawers and went out and looked for a job to get them through the next year of school. They certainly were proud of what they'd done, but some of them never even told their children about this gold medal till much later in life. They were very focused on moving forward, on getting ahead in the world. So I think they were all proud of it. I think it gave them a great deal of confidence later in life. But mostly they didn't make a big deal about it. In terms of its effect on me, the whole, learning the story and researching it and writing it have just been probably the best 5 years of my life. I've just enjoyed it so much. It's been transformative in many ways. But I think the thing it's really taught me is sort of the power of humility. I didn't think about this when I was writing the book, but after I was done with the book and it was off to the printer, I did sit down and tried to think about what the story meant to me, and it suddenly dawned on me that I think this story of these nine young Americans, working-class American kids, who climbed in a boat and learned to pull together so beautifully and so powerfully, I think that's an almost perfect metaphor for what that whole generation of Americans did. That generation found themselves in the same boat in the Great Depression. And somehow they found a way to trust one another, come together, to start pulling together, and get great things done. Things like building the Grand Coulee Dam and winning World War II on not one but two fronts, and building the most prosperous era in our history. So for me, it's been a lesson, and I think that the humility that these guys felt about themselves and the way they trusted one another and approached one another is sort of emblematic of what that whole generation did and why they were, you know, Tom Brokaw called them the greatest generation, and I think that's how they became the greatest generation.
Well, Daniel James Brown, it's an incredibly inspirational story. I want to thank you so much for talking with us about The Boys in the Boat.
Great. Well, thanks so much for having me on.
The American Booksellers Association has voted The Boys in the Boat the 2014 Nonfiction Book of the Year. Go to writersvoice.net to see the thrilling final minutes of the race that won the gold for the U.S. team. Next up, a retelling of the story of Romeo and Juliet from the nurse's point of view. Stay tuned after the break.
Thus from my lips, by yours my sin is purged.
And have my lips the sin that they have took.
Sin from my lips, oh trespass, sweetly urged, give me my sin again.
You kiss by the book.
Juliet, you the girl of my dreams. You got me down on my knees, you giving me what I need.
Romeo, you spitting some hotness. It's harder not this, nobody could stop this.
Juliet, you the girl of my dreams. You got me down on my knees.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. But soft, what light through yonder window breaks? It is the east, and Juliet is the sun. Ah, the immortal words of Romeo, greeting the celestial vision of his love as she emerges on her balcony. But in Lois Levine's new novel, Juliet's Nurse, Romeo is not the shining youth of Shakespeare's play, but someone much more problematic, at least in the eye of the book's eponymous character. Levine is a historian-turned-novelist. We spoke with her last about her book, The Secrets of Mary Bowser, a novel about a real African-American spy in the Confederate White House. In Juliet's Nurse, she turns her historical talents to 14th-century Italy, a time of plague, violence, and rigid hierarchy, but also a society on the leading edge of the Renaissance. We get the imagined backstory of Shakespeare's tale, told from the point of view of Juliet's nurse, a generous and bawdy soul who loves her young charge with all her heart, even though it means she has to live apart from her own beloved husband. In this 450th year since Shakespeare's birth, Levine's novel gives us a sense of history from the woman's perspective. A woman who, as both insider and outsider, has much to say about the intrigues and passions of Verona's ruling elite.
Well, Lois Levine, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you again.
I think I can call this a historical novel, even though it's about a fictional character. The second historical novel we've talked to you about, the last one was Mary Bowser. Very different time and place. Juliet's Nurse, a retelling from the point of view of Juliet's nurse of the tale of Romeo and Juliet. Why did you decide to take this subject on as a work of fiction?
You know, I was actually working on another project and struggling with it, and one day the title Juliet's Nurse came to me, and I thought, wow, that's fantastic. And I, like most people, had not read the play since high school, so I took my copy off the shelf and sat down and read it. And in the very first scene in the play that Juliet is in, it's also the nurse's first scene. And there's a point where Lady Capulet makes a reference to Juliet's age, and the nurse says, oh, yes, I know her age exactly. And then she goes into this long speech where she talks about how she had her own child who was born the same day as Juliet but didn't live. And then she starts talking about her husband, and then she starts talking about Juliet as an infant and as a toddler. And it's very strange because this speech has no reason to be in the play, but it gives us just these glimpses into an amazing backstory and that question of what it would be like to lose a child, such a shattering experience, and then immediately have another child to care for and nurture in not just an emotionally but a really physically intimate way, but also always be the servant in her house. And there were a few other moments in the play where there were kind of interesting questions that came up around the nurse, and I just thought this would be a fascinating way to tell the story And also the realization that the whole play takes place across maybe 5 days total. And so I start the novel 14 years earlier, so you get not just the nurse's backstory, but maybe more insight into many of the characters because you see them developing over time. So Juliet, her cousin Tybalt, even Lord and Lady Capulet, I think, become different characters or deeper characters because of the time frame of the novel as opposed to the play.
And why don't you tell us now about that main character? Tell us about Juliet's nurse, Angelica.
You know, she's, I think, often in the play written off as comic, but she's also very tragic. She's had that child who died, and as it turns out, a fairly common experience that hiring wet nurses was very common in Italy in this period. It's the 14th century. Even middle-class families, or what we would call middle-class families, and certainly wealthy families, and often women who had just lost their own child. But I didn't want to make her defined just by that either. She has a husband who she loves very much. In some ways, she has the struggle of having to choose between spending time with Juliet, especially as Juliet gets older, and spending time with her husband. She has a more developed past as well. In the play, there's a reference to the plague, and it made me think about what that would mean. The plague first came to Italy in the middle of the 14th century, and in a space of about 2 years, killed 40% of the population. So I set the novel 10 years after that has happened. So people aren't living through the plague. They're living through kind of the aftermath of it. What does it mean to have survived something when so many people died, and to not really know why somebody would have survived or somebody would have died in terms of their understanding of medicine in the period? So she has both a sense of loss that has defined part of her life, but also a real sense of survival, and thinking about how those two things will play against each other as her relationship with Juliet, with the rest of Juliet's family, develops, and as we start to catch up with the events that people may or may not remember, depending on how well they remember Romeo and Juliet.
She's not just lost one child, but she's lost all her children through this plague.
Yes, and, you know, in thinking about just that, somebody asked me recently, well, so does she believe in fate, or does she believe in an individual's ability to change things? And I thought, well, I think it has to be both. I mean, she is she's a character both in the play and certainly in my novel who is always trying to get her way, even though she doesn't have a lot of power compared to this wealthy family that she serves. She's always sort of strategizing, not so much for herself, but for Juliet. And so she really does believe that the actions that we take can have a huge difference. But on the other hand, living in that time period with such a degree of loss, and a loss that would touch people across class lines. So thinking about, again, how do you make sense of the world, and how do you go on with that experience, and what would drive her, and how do you find joy again after losing what would be a total of 7 children in her case?
And then when she does lose that daughter, you know, a daughter of her older age, of her middle age, you know, she's not a young spring chicken at that point. She has had this long-lasting marriage with her husband, Pietro. She gets this job that takes her away from her husband, from the memories. The job is to nurse Juliet. And as some of our listeners may not know what a wet nurse is, so you can explain that. And also explain, what does she find? What kind of a society now, high society, does she come into?
Sure. So a wet nurse is literally somebody who would breastfeed a child. And again, it was fairly common to hire out that task, which seems a little strange to us, I suppose. But it was a common practice then. And of course, it's always a great setup for a novel to start with somebody entering a new world. And in this case, going from being not well off at all in Verona to walking into one of the wealthiest and most powerful households, because it gives your narrator a chance to observe things, which is a great way to share that world with the reader, that the narrator is seeing it with fresh eyes. And some of it is really just slowing down what comes quickly in the play, that Juliet has this cousin Tybalt who seems to be attached to her family's household but has no parents of his own. So he is a motherless child who's 10 when the nurse arrives in the household. So it's not just Juliet that she becomes a surrogate mother for, but Tybalt as well, and their relationship developing over time, and the way that he is also a comfort for the loss of her sons to the plague, in the same way that Juliet is a comfort for the loss of her daughter, who has died just after birth. And also thinking about the rest of that household, I mean, we know even in the play, Lady Capulet was very young. She was probably about 15 when she gave birth to Juliet. So in some ways, she is also a child in this household, although she is in the role of the lady of the house, and there's an awful lot of tension, but also some deep connection that ends up happening in the novel between Angelica. And I have, unlike Shakespeare, I'm more of a historian, and so I want to get my history right. So he has made their names not very Italian. So in the book, it's Lady Capuletta as opposed to Lady Capulet. But the relationship between Angelica and Lady Capuletta becomes deeper, I think, and more fully realized, but also an interesting contrast, because there's a way in which Angelica is allowed to nurture Juliet and Tybalt, and whether it's her refusal or Lady Capuletta's refusal, she doesn't have quite that same relationship, even though Lady Capuletta is probably 30 years younger than she is when she arrives in the household.
And we're talking with author Lois Levine about her latest novel. It's Juliet's Nurse. It's a retelling, or it's not so much a retelling as a telling of the backstory and then retelling of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, told from the point of view of the nurse. And her relationship, that is Angelica, the nurse's relationship to Juliet, I think even it sometimes borders on, well, more than borders on obsession, it is obsession. And there is an idea that's driving this obsession in Angelica that becomes kind of a mystery at the heart of this novel.
Yeah, you know, I don't think of it necessarily as a mystery per se, but her attachment, it's such a fascinating thing to write first-person fiction, which, you know, both of my first two novels have been, because I like first-person, even as a reader, I'm drawn to it, especially in historical works, because I think it gives you a greater sense of immediacy. You're really connecting with characters, as opposed to feeling that huge gap that centuries will put between our own experience and what characters are going through in the novel. So I really like the immediacy of first-person fiction, but it also means you only have what your narrator tells you is true and the extent to which you do or don't believe that. And I'll say I love Angelica as a character, and I loved seeing the world through her eyes and imagining her experiences, but I don't know that she's always telling the truth. I certainly would agree with your characterization of her as obsessive, especially about Juliet. And yet again, I think in a way, understandably so, that I never wanted her to seem over the top, that if she is obsessed, it is an obsession that comes out of such a deep, deep love and a desire to try and protect and care for a child in a world in which all one's experience teaches you that it's impossible to truly protect a child.
And especially in Verona of the 14th century, you must have done a lot of research for this book. Talk about the society. I mean, a society that is really driven by honor and revenge.
Yes. I think for many people, they come away from Romeo and Juliet and they say, but I don't get it. Why were they fighting? And it's not ever spelled out in the play, but it really was very much part of the culture at that time. There would be fights between families that might last generations, so that you would remember something that had happened 3 or 4 generations back, and you would really be thinking about how to avenge some wrong that had happened that far back, long before you were born. That there was huge violence in the streets. You know, one of the documents I looked at whenever I could, documents from the period, and there's some documents about the street fighting in Florence, a neighboring city, and there were brawls in the street. Young men, so probably between the ages of 15 and 25, what we would consider late adolescence, and they might have 500 people on each side brawling in the streets. Now, imagine that. You can't even know who's on your side or really have a particular purpose in mind. It was just this incredibly violent society, and in some ways, because she's in this wealthy household, she's more protected because she's sort of shut inside, but also more exposed to it because a lot of that revenge came from the families that had more power. That if you have ever had the experience of traveling to Italy, and I did go to Verona to do some of the really critical research for the book, there are still towers in a lot of Italian cities that date from this period, and each family would have essentially their own tower, sort of a mini fortress from which they could throw things down or shoot arrows at rival families as they were passing in the streets. And I think it's really, it's difficult for us to comprehend what it would be like for that to be sort of the regular feature of society. And for her to see that, especially in terms of her relationship with Tybalt, he's 10 when the novel starts. So as it progresses, he's sort of aging into that era in a boy's life when he can really get sucked into these things. So watching that and thinking about it, you know, we think through, as writers, you think through everything that you have. So thinking about what it's like to raise teenagers in our own era and how similar or different it would be in such a violent society, but also a society, as you said, really driven by honor, that it wasn't random violence, it wasn't haphazard violence, that there was a sense that there was a right thing to do and that would carry you to violence. And how do you negotiate that against the very real consequences of violence?
Now, I was really interested in the whole exploration of the position of women. I mean, I think you've alluded to it a bit, but there is the nurse, Angelica, who in some ways is freer. Less free in many ways, but in some ways freer than the noble women in the book. There's also a nun, Rosalind, Tybalt's sister, and, you know, Juliet herself, of course, now she falls in love with someone from, you know, a rival family, as we know very well from the story. Talk a little bit about the position of women, and was there any inkling? I mean, after all, this is a romantic story. Is that romance medieval style, or is there the beginning of a kind of modern sense of romance in this story as well?
Sure. Well, I think that you hit on a few really important themes in the novel and in the historical period, that it's true that daughters were, and sons too for that matter, marriages were arranged by families, and they were arranged around political and social and business economic alliances. So that would have affected sons as well as daughters. But certainly the case that we see that with Juliet, and I get to sort of make up the story of how the Capulettis, Lord Capuletto and Lady Capuletta, how their marriage came to be, which is almost shocking for Angelica to hear because her family has nothing. She gets to have a love match. There's nobody who's trying to angle for, you know, to get her dowry or to get her Pietro's, you know, political power. They don't have money. They don't have political power. So that they get to have a love match, that once you are in a position where your family has money, has power, has aspirations, you really don't get to have. So in some ways it is true that it's a kind of a modern notion, the love match, but I think it also was much more of a fact of life for people who were in a lower class position as opposed to an upper class position. And thinking about how to differentiate between the experiences that women have depending on what kind of families they're born into, and very much an accident of fate, that, you know, Rosaline's story is maybe not as deeply told in either the novel or in the play, but that she really does represent the fact that there was this other space for women. Sometimes women became nuns because they were deeply religious. Sometimes they became nuns because they didn't have enough dowry money in their family, and so it was kind of cheaper to stick you in a convent because I didn't have a way to marry you off, dear daughter. But then there are these spaces where women are living together kind of outside of what's happening in the rest of society. So it was really compelling for me to kind of try and understand how that worked for different women and to represent it in the novel. And again, I really am driven by questions of trying to understand a historical moment and then how to convey that to readers in terms of the story and particularly the characters.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Lois Levine about her novel Juliet's Nurse, based on Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet.
Now, in terms of the historical research for Juliet's Nurse, is there a whole lot written about such working class folks as Juliet's Nurse? Or, you know, how did you get the details? Because there are a lot of details that you give to her life that kind of, you know, where you paint the historical milieu. How did you get those details?
Well, you know, I'm really trained as a historian. I have a PhD, so I know how to do research. But I would not have been able to do much of my own primary research because these records would all have been in Latin, way beyond my ken. So I looked at the work that other historians had done. I mean, there's one woman in particular who's done a lot of research on contracts that families would have with wet nurses. So that was really helpful. A series of letters that a woman had written to her husband about trying to find a wet nurse. So that was really helpful. But interestingly, set in the 14th century, the 14th century is before the printing press. So there were far fewer books because they had to be copied by hand, and we have far fewer written records for that reason. But the flip side of that is that there was so much visual material from this time period. You can look at images of women in what were called in Italy the parto room, the room where a woman would be giving birth and kind of recuperating from giving birth. And there are in religious settings, but also even on a plate or a tray that somebody might have in their house, paintings that have these rooms on them. So you can get a sense of, okay, here's where the new mother is sitting, and she's surrounded by all of her visitors, all women visitors, but this is, you know, sort of a thing that women of the upper class would do, would be to make these visits. And then off in the corner is a wet nurse breastfeeding the baby. So, the occasion of childbirth is why everybody's there, but they're actually not paying much attention to the baby at all. So looking at visual materials like that just to get a sense of what people wore, what did the spaces and houses look like. As I mentioned, I went to Verona, and so I was able to kind of be in some of the kind of houses from this time period, even just to walk up and down at one of those towers that a family would have as part of their household fortifications, and to imagine making that climb without electric lights in, you know, what even during the daytime would have been very dark because there's almost no openings, just arrow slits. And really trying to put myself into that place. I think that that's the moment that really makes a novel come together, is when you stop thinking about the time period and start thinking as though you're in the time period. And it's so exciting when it comes together. And that's really what lets you be able to tell the story as the characters are experiencing it.
Well, you really hit that verisimilitude. And another way, and of course, is the language. In some ways, there are two different styles because the book is in two different parts. One is the prequel to Romeo and Juliet. And, you know, there are a lot of images and there is poetic language and somewhat archaic language in that. But more so in the second part, which takes place during the time that the play takes place as well. And so there you have an opportunity to use a lot of phrases from Shakespeare himself, although you don't always use them in the same place that they were used in the play. Talk a little bit about the process of developing the voice and the language, both in the first part and in the second, because I think they're different.
Sure. You know, even before I started this book, I used to say about writing dialogue, you don't want to be too forsoothy. That is to say, you don't want to go kind of over the top with trying to make something sound period. And I'm a former college professor, and I have had to guide students through reading Shakespeare plays. And I know that that language is beautiful, and I love it, but it can feel impenetrable to 21st century readers. So and Shakespeare already wrote Romeo and Juliet. I didn't need to just kind of rewrite that in his words, but wanting to have it feel like it was different enough that it felt right for the time period. And of course, Shakespeare was writing more or less 200 years after the play is set, 150, 200 years later. So even his language wouldn't necessarily have been exactly from that time period. But I also knew that there are lines that people love and cherish from Romeo and Juliet. I suppose all of us can quote at least one line from Romeo and Juliet, whether we get it exactly right or remember who said it or what had happened in the play. But those lines are so familiar to us. And yet, again, because it's first-person fiction, I can only tell what the nurse experiences. And some of the most famous lines happen when she's not in the scene. So you're right. Sometimes I move lines around or I have people repeat things so that I can give to my readers what they might want to remember from the play. But also feeling like I could convey the ideas that Shakespeare's putting out there in language that felt more accessible. So early in the novel, the nurse is just thinking about loss, and she talks about how, you know, friars will say things like, "What's tomb is womb," meaning from loss comes new life. And it's true that in the play, Friar Lawrence in particular says more or less that, but he says it in a much longer and kind of more difficult to parse way. It wouldn't have been difficult for Shakespeare's original audience and for people who love to see Shakespeare plays today. I don't think it's that difficult. But saying what's tomb is womb kind of captures that essence in what I don't think sounds like the way that I would speak to my next door neighbor if I were talking about life today, but also is more accessible than Shakespeare. So that was kind of the line that I was walking throughout the novel. Sometimes trying to incorporate, I mean, you do want to convey the sense that this is a different time and place, and also to convey the sense of what words people would know. You know, when you write historical fiction, you have to be very careful about things like metaphors, because you can only use the metaphors that your character would know. There's a point early on when Tybalt, who's still quite young, uses the word shibboleth. Well, he's from a certain class position. Angelica is from a different class position. She has no idea what this word means. And so that's part of what happens in that scene, is that she has to actually think about how to respond to somebody who has access to language that she doesn't have. So even in ways like that, wanting to differentiate between the characters, not just to say, oh, they're in this oldie-timey place that's different from how we are today, but what kind of language do different characters have, and how does that tell us about who they are and what their expectations of the world are?
Well, it's really a delightful read. It's Juliet's Nurse, Lois Levine. I just love the way you describe the whole process of writing historical fiction, and also so much about writing it in this book. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
You're quite welcome. It's always a pleasure.
You can read an excerpt from Lois Levine's novel, Juliet's Nurse, at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.